Ladies and gentlemen, to a very special episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, where we have a guest in studio. His name is Arik Rees. He's the maker of the upcoming documentary film Drug Lord, which is spelled L-A-W-E-D. So it's www.druglord.com. And he's basically needing a whole lot of pledges and DVD pre-sales and things of that nature in order to get the documentary film finished right here in New Zealand. Arik, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Vinny.
Well, tell us a little bit about the doco, what you do, who you are, you know, for those who don't know.
Sure. It started in 2009 in the middle of a riot where I was in Dunedin, and one of the Undy 500 riots had gone completely out of control, and there was about 2,000 or 3,000 students throwing bottles at the cops. And there was another set of cops just a few blocks away harassing the stoners who were peacefully engaging them and trying to educate them. And this contradiction between the alcohol laws and the cannabis laws became just too stark for me to ignore. So I turned my documentary filmmaking skills to investigate New Zealand's cannabis laws. And almost 4.5 years on, I'm nearly finished the epic documentary Drug Lord, how New Zealand Green got rolled up in the U.S. drug war.
Well, what's your conclusion based upon the law itself? I mean, do we have old-school drug laws like they did back in the 60s where you go for years for like 5 grams or something? Or,
well, New Zealand has the highest arrest and conviction rate of any country in the entire world when it comes to cannabis. Sorry, I forgot to turn off my phone.
It's an item.
Hang on.
Isn't it interesting, the drug lord documentary filmmaker who's in high demand?
Okay, sorry about that, folks. What was your question, Vinny?
We were talking about in terms of how you relate the intensity of the drug laws. Like, I've seen people in the United States with, getting their hands bound around their back, the three strikes law and all of that kind of stuff. New Zealand's not that bad to people, is it?
Oh, it actually is. You find, especially to minority groups, Maori and Pacific Islanders. what happens is your likelihood of being arrested is pretty high in New Zealand. In fact, the highest in the world for cannabis. You may be let off leniently. That is true. You may get home detention. You may get a fine, etc., etc. However, your record will be permanently blighted by this completely unnecessary conviction that you will receive. And it's a conviction for a victimless crime. It's not even a crime. To call it a victimless crime is to say that it's a crime of some kind. Mm. But there's no victim. And if there's no victim, then there's no crime. It's as simple as that.
Well, there's no damage to persons or their property. Therefore, it's not unlawful, right?
Correct. Correct. Who's the complainant? Who's complaining against you if you get arrested for cannabis? The state is the complainant. Have you harmed the state in any way? The only harm you've done to the state is thumb your nose at their authority, which is your right as a citizen if the state is in the wrong. So in actual fact, it's a rights issue. You have the right to take whatever intoxicant you choose as long as it doesn't affect anybody else around you. That is your natural right as a human being, particularly when it comes to medication, which is another issue of this entire cannabis debate, that a lot of people are not taking it recreationally. It's a matter of life and death for many of these people.
Mm.
And the state is denying your right to access medicine that you need.
Mm. Well, you'd have a look at some of those individual cases of people like, Billy McKee, who runs Green Cross New Zealand, leg taken off by a drunk driver.
Exactly.
The only thing that actually helps with the pain without ridiculously psychoactive side effects that turns him into a horrible husband and father is cannabis, which keeps him calm and also relieves him of all the pain. And the secondary use that he has for it, I found particularly interesting, is raw cannabis bud simply tapered onto his stump, which normally gets a lot of irritation if he's walking around, and it takes away the irritation and some of the inflammation.
That's been known for hundreds of years, actually. The cannabis leaves were used to bandage wounds in China 3,000 years ago. That's what they were being used for, to reduce inflammation. Corn plasters were being made out of cannabis 100 years ago to reduce inflammation. It's the same principle. So we've got this natural medicine, which you can produce free, which you don't have to go to the healthcare system for and, you know, impose costs on the taxpayer. But you're not allowed to grow it. You're not allowed to produce it. You're not allowed to possess it. You're not allowed to trade in it. So we've got a total prohibition in New Zealand. It is illegal in New Zealand to possess a single seed of cannabis, unless it's a hemp seed, and there are only 4 people licensed to grow hemp seeds, to grow hemp in this country.
Well, the power to license is the power to take away.
Exactly.
Why do we need licenses? I mean, where's the danger in hemp? I mean, well, there is a danger, but here's the thing. There's 2 perspectives on this. Are you a psychopath who loves making money and loves hurting people? No, you're not. So you wouldn't understand why the drug laws are the way they are. If you were, on the other hand, one of those people, that'd make total sense to you, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Our drug laws exist to keep the drug warriors in business. And the side effect is that you're keeping the real drug lords, the real gangs who are dealing in drugs, in business as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the primary reason we have drug laws in this country is because it services the needs of the drug warriors.
Who are these drug warriors?
The number one drug warrior is Peter Dunn.
Oh, yeah.
Who, am I allowed to say Peter Dunhill Stuyvesant? Is he
sponsored by the tobacco industry?
There is a lot of evidence to indicate that he is, and I haven't gone through his voting record with a fine-tooth comb yet, but I have seen consistencies in his voting which indicate that whenever there's a decision to be made in Parliament, Dunn always favors the tobacco companies. In the ones that I've investigated, he consistently votes for the tobacco companies' interests.
Pay the piper, call the tune, as it were.
Exactly. I'll give you one example. When the ban on indoor smoking in certain areas was proposed, Dunn was dead set against that. He said it's an impingement on the rights of companies to sell their product in a free market system. Doesn't matter that the product being sold is the deadliest drug in the world, by far the deadliest drug in the world.
And cannabis is like 87th,
It's not on the deadly list, because it's never, as far as all the scientists and doctors that I've interviewed during the course of this last 4.5 year shoot, have all told me it's caused 0 deaths that they know of. So there might be, who knows, there might be 10 deaths. There might be 5 deaths a year. Let's be generous and say there's 5 deaths from cannabis a year. Well, that's still 6.5 million less than die of cigarettes every year.
Mm, and you're talking globally?
Globally, yes.
Okay. 6.5 million deaths versus 5. Keep the baccy legal and axe it up with 700 chemicals, which are dangerous and known carcinogens.
Yes.
Were people dying of lung cancer before they started adding all these additives and things like that to regular pipe tobacco and stuff like that? I wonder.
Well, I've often thought that. I haven't researched it, but if you take the tobacco leaf straight off the of the tobacco plant, which you can do, and roll it up and smoke it straight away, or dry it and smoke it without adding anything, it's reasonable to assume that the same kinds of diseases that result from the adulterated tobacco, which most people smoke, won't result from somebody smoking pure tobacco.
Mm. Well, can I also make an observation? Because what it seems to me be is that many people might grow tobacco because we've tobacco is legal in this country. You can mm-hmm. grow it. Mm-hmm. I've tried it myself, and it's ridiculously difficult to get the seeds to germinate. Mm-hmm. And depending on the climate, sometimes they don't grow at all. And it also takes an awful long time to dry, mm-hmm. and it's meticulous to cut it. It's a lot of effort. Most people will not go through that kind of effort.
That is true.
So, and that's a legal drug that anybody can grow for free. I presume the same would be for cannabis. There would still be a larger buyer's market than there would be a grower's market because it's a lot of effort, isn't it?
It is an effort to grow decent cannabis. There would be still a number of people who want to buy it, and therefore we do need to regulate the production of it because it is a drug. It may be one of the least addictive and least harmful drugs out there, but it is still a drug, and therefore it needs regulations and controls so that kids don't get it, which they're doing now, so that people aren't misusing it, and that those people who are having a problem with it, well, they can seek recourse to get help without interdiction from the criminal justice system.
And are there other case studies of places where they have treatment programs and things of that nature for people who are, you know, just so whacked out on cannabis that it's destroying their life? They can go to mm-hmm. this place, detox, and suss it out.
Here in New Zealand,
or anywhere.
Well, the luminary examples are Portugal and the Netherlands. Portugal decriminalized all drugs across the board in 2000. What they found there was that drug use decreased by half, crimes associated with drugs decreased by half, diseases associated with drugs decreased by half, and the overall cost to society decreased by half. So it was a massive win. And the problem there was that they were getting resistance from the United Nations and from America, who were saying, no, you cannot decriminalize drugs, because we have to be committed to the drug war and the program of suppressing drugs through the criminal justice system. And, of course, they just turned around and said, no, this is costing us too much. We have the highest drug rate use in Europe. We're going to decriminalize, and we will assess the situation. Well, 10 years on, it's been a complete victory. You know, they've succeeded in every single facet that they intended to succeed. So what does that tell you? I mean, why is the rest of the world still plodding down the road to ruin with the drug war?
Ki bono, who benefits? I do know that the CIA runs huge quantities of heroin around the world. Is there also a cannabis element to that
well?
In any realms of officialdom, organized crime, etc., that may be currently involved with cannabis that do not want it legalized and regulated because, hey, then the price would drop drastically, wouldn't it?
That's true. That's not strictly true. What you'd have is a high excise tax to keep the price pretty constant because you don't want the price to fall too much, otherwise use will increase. You don't want to create a situation where everybody's high on cannabis all the time because it's so readily available and so cheap. So to keep the price consistent, you have a high excise tax. What's the purpose of that high excise tax? Well, you take that money and you put it in the health system. And all the people who do present problems, which won't be very many, but those people that do require help or intervention, well, they have this huge pool of money to draw from, and they're not causing any costs to any other part of society. The cannabis users are paying for the problems of the cannabis users. Whereas today, you've got the entire country paying for the problems of the alcoholics, paying for the problems of the people dying from tobacco-related illnesses, and people dying from pharmaceutical problems as well. Those are the three most dangerous classes of drugs, and they're all legal.
I would act under the assumption that if a medical patient was capable of growing their own cannabis, it would be much less a drain on any health system, regardless. I mean, the savings for treating somebody with multiple sclerosis or glaucoma or cancers and things of that nature
would
be astronomical.
That's true.
You could practically shut down half the health system.
Well, here's the thing. If people were actually advised to eat raw bud, which has no psychoactive effects, it's purely a boost to your immune system, and it has ameliorative effects on a number of diseases. And it seems to have preventative effects on a number of diseases. So if you were to eat raw cannabis every day, you'd probably not experience any of the health problems that we're experiencing so commonly in society today.
Now, there's also hemp seed as well, which is
superfood.
You know,
it can live on it.
Well, quite literally, I believe there was a town in northern Australia, around Darwin or something of that nature, that went through an enormous drought for a number of years, and the only thing they had to eat was hemp seed, and they were fine.
Hemp seed and water. That's all you need to live.
Mm.
And furthermore, I mean, the hemp seed itself, it can be pressed and made into oil for salads, for example. It can be made into oil for your skin, for your lips, for your hair. We made into shampoo, soap, etc. So if you have one single plant, you know, that you can farm, it should be hemp because you can make food. You can make building materials. You can make dynamite, cellophane. You can make 50,000 things from it that are currently being produced at a huge economic cost and carbon cost by oil-based products.
Okay. Well, the other element here is also every establishment that has existed throughout history has fought tooth and nail to prevent its own demise, right?
That's true.
So what's happening here, I believe, with cannabis is not only are you threatening, say, black ops budgets, because if you're turning it legal, sure, people can still make money off it, but it's got to be money on the books. If you've got money off the books, that's cash for any operations you want.
Absolutely.
And so there's a threat there to whatever skullduggery and scumbaggery is going on within intelligence services or whatever. There's an incentive for them to sell and ship and distribute the drugs themselves.
That's right.
And the other establishments are, of course, if there's 50,000 industrial products, that means there must be 50,000 different forms of industry that would either have to adapt or simply wouldn't survive.
Well, they would have competition that they currently do not have, most notably the oil companies, because you think that you're paying however many dollars at the pump. What you're paying is that plus the subsidies that are being drawn from, you know, the public's coffers and given to these oil companies, which is a massive thing in the United States. Half the cost of oil is borne by the taxpayer, half the cost of gasoline, I should say. So people think that that hemp or hemp-based biofuels can't compete in price. But in actual fact, if you remove those oil subsidies, they're equivalent in price at a negative up or something. Zero. For the fuel, it's a zero carbon cost for building materials, negative carbon cost.
Right. Arik Reese, maker of the documentary Drug Lord at druglord.com. That's Drug Lord with a W. We'll be right back after the break. TheNewsShow.com.
On December 16th, 1961, the world turned upside down, then inside out, and I was born screaming in America. It was the tail end of the American dream. Just before we lost our innocence irrevocably, when the TV eye brought the horror of our lives into our homes for all to see. I was told when I grew up I could be anything I wanted. A fireman, a policeman, a doctor, even president it seemed. And for the first time in the history of mankind, something new called an astronaut. But like many kids growing up on a steady diet of Westerns, I always wanted to be the cowboy hero. That lone voice in the wilderness, fighting corruption and evil wherever I found it, and standing for freedom, truth, and justice. And in my heart of hearts, I still track the remnants of that dream wherever I go in my never-ending ride into the setting sun.
Right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chains nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy, according to John Key, because now everybody can get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest is Arik Reese, and the maker of the documentary film DrugLord.com. That's law as in the one that suppresses you. Arik, what were we talking about just before we got off to a break there is the different beneficiaries of the drug laws being where they are, financial and also power grabbing, I found is very interesting.
Oh, yes.
You've got the ability to search people without warrants, and if they find something, hey, it doesn't matter if they violated your rights in order to get it. Hey, we found something.
Correct. The search and surveillance bill that was passed recently in New Zealand, it has the drug laws woven into it. The police can kick down your door to search for drugs. They could search your car, your person. They can't do that for a stolen TV. So for the police, it might not even be so much about the drug laws so much as the powers that it grants them to do general policing. And if they net people for drugs, well, that's just great for them because it's overtime. You know, it's an easy bust a lot of the time. You don't want to be running after some burglar in the middle of the street trying to chase down an actual criminal when you can just roll a pothead who's not going to resist you and, you know, who's going to be a little naughty badge on your report card so that you can move up the chain of command.
Yeah. Well, can I also make an observation? Does that make police, in a lot of senses, just kind of cowards? They don't actually want to put themselves in danger in order to make society safer. They'd rather hurt people who really have never hurt anybody else, not even themselves, if then, and they'd rather spend their time doing that?
Well, I'd agree with that. I think the days of people being drawn to the police force because they are brave and they are honorable and they want society to be a better place, I think those days are over because of the selection process that's involved.
Could you explain the selection process?
Well, when you apply for a job at the police force, they're going to exclude you if you have any involvement in drugs whatsoever. So if you have actually any contact with drugs, any personal experience with drugs, and therefore a deeper knowledge of what drugs do to you, you'll be automatically excluded. So what you're left with is a pool of people who essentially they hate drug users. Of course, it's a double standard because they've got nothing against drug users who are using alcohol, drug users who are using tobacco, and drug users who are using pharmaceuticals. It's the ones that they're programmed to dislike, principally cannabis. There are other drugs as well, you know, but cannabis is by far the main illicit drug used not only in New Zealand, across the world. So if you legalize cannabis, the problem shrinks by about 75% overnight. The drug problem that's perceived to exist in society because people are using illegal drugs. And, of course, they ignore the fact that there's a drug problem in society which is far more deadly. It's the legal drug problem, but let's just look at the illicit drugs. Take out cannabis from the equation. The drug problem diminishes to negligible size. The number of people using meth, cocaine, heroin, all of these other drugs that are actually deadly and are corrosive to your body, it's a minute number of people. You wouldn't be able to justify the billion-dollar budgets, well, multi-million-dollar budgets in New Zealand, but billion-dollar budgets in the States, to crush this supposed problem.
Well, then cannabis is basically the ultimate I can violate your rights excuse, because so many people do it, you could bust anybody and just claim that they smelt cannabis or anything like that. You can't say, I claim to have smelt your ecstasy tablets.
Exactly. You can't say I've claimed to smell your stolen TV, you know, or whatever the case may be. But cannabis is a peach, you know, it's the low-hanging fruit because you can make up the pretense to search the person. And we've seen it a number of times in the past. Chris Fowley commendably defended himself against such an accusation made by a policeman who searched him and found cannabis, and he fought a tooth and nail in the courts, and the judge declared that he was innocent, or rather that the search was illegal, and his charges were dismissed, even though cannabis was found in him. So good going, Chris Fowley. Well done.
Well, yeah, I mean, it shows that basically there's no excuse across the board in any way, shape, or form for cannabis prohibition. Maybe arguments can be made about the other drugs, but that's not what we're focusing on here. It shouldn't be illegal. There is no moral justification. There is no legal justification. There is no ethical justification. There is no justification of any kind.
That's correct. These laws are based on lies. The initial drive to make cannabis illegal was all based on racism. It dates back to the 1912 Harrison Act. The first marijuana laws passed in the United States were in in Texas and California when they noticed that Mexicans were smoking marijuana. The term marijuana was actually introduced by Randall Hearst, but I'll get to that later. It was called cannabis in the United States up until the 1920s and 30s when this term was injected into the public lexicon.
Well, cannabis was everywhere. It was all over the recipe books. Everybody, medicines was made out of it.
Lemonade. It was an ingredient in lemonade. So you put cannabis leaves in your salad. Very healthy and tasty and non-psychoactive. So all of these other things that the plants were used for, they were being used, you know, all over the world. In fact, it was being grown on six continents. It's one of the hardiest plants on our planet. You don't need pesticides. You don't need fertilizers. You don't need much water to grow it. It grows in it even grows in irradiated soil around Chernobyl, where they're using it as a mop crop to get the radiation out of the ground. So here's a plant which you can grow practically anywhere for practically no investment and get a 50,000 different products from it, which you can either eat, which you can either make into medicines, which you can turn into textiles or building materials or fuel. Or paper, the best paper in the world, in fact. Paper that's lasted several hundred years longer than the paper that we currently produce
today.
Didn't
a dude also build a car out of it?
Henry Ford,
Not just Henry Ford. I know he built hemp and fueled it on hemp as mm-hmm, well. But mm-hmm. just more recently, a guy made a sports car and used hemp for the panel.
Yep, yes, that's right. It was in Drive magazine. Not just the paneling, the upholstery. There was the... I'm not exactly sure of the details, so I don't want to go into that. But getting back to Henry Ford's hemp car, practically the entire car was biodegradable. The body was six times lighter than steel and 10 times the tensile strength. So imagine if for the last 80 years we'd been driving around in cars made from cannabis, which the father of the modern automobile intended, we'd have... no pollution. I mean, well, we'd have a lot less pollution, definitely. I mean, with cars being fueled on carbon zero fuel, and also 1/6 the weight. So you need 1/6 the fuel to get the car around. So and the fuel can be locally produced. So you don't need to burn fuel to get the oil, which we're doing now, from the place where it's being extracted to the refinery to the pump. You can grow the cannabis locally, turn it into fuel locally, like you can do with lots of biofuels, and you can distribute it right there where it's being made.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
It is. And in a country like New Zealand, where you've got tracts of arable land which are currently being used to grow nothing or grass or things like corn, which we need less of, you could be growing hemp. And here's another interesting fact. Down in the northern part of Wellington, they are planting fields of cannabis, letting it grow for 3 months, harvesting the cannabis, processing the herd into building materials and building the house on site, so that there's no oil involved in transporting the building materials to the site. And there's no oil being burned in producing the building materials, which can be done by hand. So you can actually build a house which locks in carbon, right, without burning any fuel except maybe, you know, to bring people to the site, bring the workers to the site. Mm-hmm. And you have a house that is better than the house that you're living in now that's made from brick and mortar. It's insulated, self-insulating. The cannabis walls will eventually petrify and turn to stone. You can make the carpets out of it. You can make the paints out of it. You can make your furniture out of it. You can make an entire house out of cannabis, and you can make biofuels to cook with as well.
Everything methanol. Everything except the electrical appliances, basically.
Well, yeah, that's correct. You need to have those produced somewhere else, but you can run those off generators using cannabis-based methanol. So,
I wonder if you could build a generator out of hemp and run it on hemp fuel.
I would say that's almost possible. I would say you would need to have refined metals in that, but that basically you could make most of that generator out of cannabis, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it's basically the what Jack Harris said is that hemp could save the world. We've got so many problems, all of which not just some of which, but all of which can be solved with hemp. Okay, we've got corrupt politicians who won't listen. Smoke a joint. We've got cars that are real expensive to produce and basically weak. You know, they get smashed up every time, and it costs you huge amounts to repair them. Make them out of hemp. You've got all these pesticides and herbicides and things like that being sprayed all over your food and everything like that, and the soil's got no nutrients, and it grows some hemp in it, bro. It churns up the soil, makes everything a hell of a lot better. Every single thing that you point at, pretty much, that is in any way or shape or form a problem to our current society, from the radiation poisoning to the fuel shortages to the food shortages to the everything else shortages, the intellectual shortages, you know what I'm saying? Because I spoke to, it was a Bob Malamed, Dr. Bob Malamed, about this, and he says that society's basically turned into this the sort of war between what he calls backward-looking people and forward-looking people, or blips and flips. And he found out that endocannabinoids, cannabinoids from within, are actually some of the keystone to our evolution and actually facilitate higher thoughts, higher states of consciousness, and they regulate as well all the building blocks of our bodies. So it's good inside, it's good outside, in every way you can think of, and there's no justification to keep it illegal. Now, we keep running over that same ground. You know, why there's no justification, it's very good, etc. You know, it's been done to death. And yet, the motivation out there for people to stand up and just say, hey, no, and plenty of people do, yet the effect has not been quite as big as one might hope. Now, you were going back to racism. You know, the original reason why this drug was outlawed in the United States was racism.
That's absolutely true. You have the original drug czar, Harry Anslinger, making statements like the hot hay causes Negroes to rape white women, and to commit the offense of standing on a white man's shadow. That's an actual quote after they smoked marijuana. It was also the racism of Randall Hearst, who hated immigrants, absolutely hated immigrants, and hated the jazz movement. And there was this association between cannabis, which they called marijuana, and these people who they disliked. And it was very easy to then invent stories of murders, rapes being committed by these minority groups because they were under the effects of marijuana. And, it just so happens that Randall Hearst owned vast forestry concerns, and the wood pulp paper industry was one of the basis of his outrageous fortune, and it was being threatened by the new inventions that were being made in hemp production, so which would have then made better, cheaper paper. And, hemp is cannabis. People wouldn't be able to distinguish between the two if you just renamed it marijuana, which Anslinger and he did in the newspapers that he was releasing.
Well, so it's a Mexican nickname. Mari means Mary, and Juana means Jane.
And it wasn't even a popular Mexican slang term for it. They chose one that was really obscure so that people wouldn't know that they were talking about cannabis in these news releases. Everybody knew what cannabis was. It was in half the medicines at the turn of the century. There was huge tracts of hemp being grown, which they called cannabis hemp or hemp alternatively, in Missouri, in Kansas, in Arkansas,
Alabama,
Kentucky. There was something like 2,500 registered hemp plantations in 1910, and that's excluding the smaller farms. So there was cannabis all over the United States.
Well, cannabis is as American as apple pie, you know. What was his name? George Washington. He was a hemp farmer as well.
First four presidents were.
Had wooden teeth. He was smoking it. They analyzed his pipe. It's got marijuana residue in it.
He wrote about it in his journals, saying that the thing he loved most is sitting on his porch and smoking fine hemp in his pipe.
Now, how little things change over time. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Arik Reese is my guest, the maker of Drug Lord, the documentary at druglord.com.
Gentlemen, to the show that's all about drug dealing and organized crime, just like we do back home in Sicily at the Chateau de Rothschild. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And my very special guest, who knows intricately my very special business, Arik Reese, the maker of the documentary Drug Lord at druglord.com. Now, we're talking about pledges, right? Some people out there gotta buy a few of your DVDs in advance so that you can actually finish the film. Is that about right?
That's about right, Vinny. We've spent a lot of money on this film, and we still have a lot of money to spend, which we don't have. We're determined to finish regardless. But it would be very helpful if the folks out there would support us by going to www.druglord.com. You'll see a link to Pledge Me in our website. Click that link, and there you can make a pledge, which is basically an advanced order on our DVD or our merchandising, and that will support us in getting to the finish line here.
Okay. And then how long have you said you've been making this film for like the best part of 4 years?
Started it in August 2009.
Now, there's a documentary uploaded to my YouTube channel called, what was it, Time for Change New Zealand or something.
That was the first little shortcut that I released about this subject.
Yeah, and that was produced by Top Shelf Productions, I believe. And I remember visiting you at the studios there and seeing all this storyboarding and stuff all over the walls, huge quantities of work going into it. I think you were like working 70-hour weeks or something of that nature, getting that puppy together.
Yes, easily 70 hours a week. That lasted for several months. We got a huge budget from New Zealand On Air to produce this TV show, Inside New Zealand, High Time. It got Pick of the Week twice, when it was first released and when it was rerun. It was nominated for Pick of the Week by the TV Times. It told the story from the televisual perspective, which means you can't really take the stand that you want. You have to be sort of neutral to get it past the Broadcasting Standards Authority. So I determined then that I was going to re-release this whole thing as a feature-length documentary, which would be able to express the real issues without pandering to the kind of middle-class mediocrity which television has to do.
Well, can I ask then, do they have any ownership over the footage, concepts, ideas, and anything like that? You know,
no.
Sometimes there's stand-down periods for a number of years for filmmakers.
No. The deal that I organized was that I could reuse the footage for my own nefarious purposes.
Okay. Well, it's a nefarious purpose indeed. So, where exactly do we want to go from here? Because we've talked about the racism element, why it was made illegal by Harry Anslinger?
Jay Anslinger.
Isn't that interesting?
Jay. Who, incidentally, was a drug addict when he died, addicted to morphine painkillers. So the great drug warrior that established the system was a drug addict himself towards the end of his life.
Now, isn't that strange? Are you saying that somebody who lied to get a frivolous law instituted was also a hypocrite?
Wouldn't be the first time. So, I don't know at what age he was when he became a morphine addict, but he did die a morphine addict. So, you know, in the last 5, maybe 10 years of his life.
Yeah. Well, who knows? He could have been addicted to it the whole time and just keeping it under the radar.
You know? Well, you know, there's a high degree of alcoholism, which is drug use, legal drug use, amongst the drug warrior fraternity. They like their tipple. Richard Nixon enjoyed drink, was often, you know, imbibing his whiskeys in the White House and the Oval Office. So you've got drug use throughout, throughout the ranks of the drug warriors, whether it's legal or sometimes even illegal drugs. Mm-hmm. You've also got the same criminal activity that they're charging the rest of us with being committed on a hideous scale. But
it makes normal criminals and normal organized crime look like a child on a trike riding down the,
exactly,
on the wrong side
exactly.
of the road. You know, it's just nothing.
Exactly. Some people may recall, and this will be in the film, the first Bush 1, holding up a bag of crack cocaine and saying, "This is crack cocaine, and it's the worst thing ever." Well, it just so happens that the CIA, and this is in a book called Dark Alliance by Gary Webb, the CIA was running huge quantities of cocaine into Los Angeles.
While George H.W. Bush was the director of the
correct,
CIA.
Correct, exactly.
How do you think he got
time,
that bag to hold up?
Well, after the crack cocaine epidemic had been started, George Bush subsequently became president. But yes, you're right, Bush was the director of the CIA. So the guys who are peddling the drugs are also the same guys who are putting you in jail for using the drugs.
Yeah.
And profiting both ends. So
It's a massive conspiracy. I mean, there really is that element in there. And it's massive folds of it, like an onion. Isn't it interesting how one subject, like the laws on cannabis, can go into so many rabbit holes and open so many doors that it's virtually infinite? Is there a freaking end to this onion? You know, I don't know.
Well, the end to the onion, I think the onion is beginning to be peeled. Washington and Colorado states have legalized cannabis. The Department of Justice doesn't have the resources to crack down on all the mom-and-pop shops that are going to open up across those states and going to be turning over millions of dollars in taxes to the state revenue. So they cannot stop it. It's like a crack in the dam wall, and all they've got is their little child fist now because they've blown their budgets on trillion-dollar wars, and they've spent $1 trillion on the drug war so far, and they've been going backwards the whole time. And it's the dam wall's cracked, and the crack's going to open, and then the flood is going to come, and they're going to be washed away. And as soon as people realize, oh, wow, now we have legal cannabis, and the problems that we have in society related to this drug have actually decreased substantially, let's look at all these other drugs which they claim are so dangerous.
Mm.
So I think that what will happen is eventually you're going to have legalization of other drugs. It's not just going to stop at cannabis. And once that happens, you know, people are going to start questioning other things that they're being told, because this is one of the biggest lies. They've been perpetuating this lie for about 100 years now. And once it's exposed, they're going to start thinking, well, what else are we being lied to about?
Have you ever seen the movie The Mist?
I haven't.
No. Oh, it's a great film, and I was just thinking about this. You're talking about the crack in the dam wall and it all flooding over. Well, this movie, The Mist, there's this kind of military facility up on a mountain or whatever, and they open a gateway to another dimension, and all these creatures in the mist and stuff like that, and it just comes out and it just spills over everything. You know, I was just thinking like that, you know, suddenly cannabis is made legal, then the whole world just gets engulfed in this mist of smokiness that goes over and just chills everybody out. And say, man, what the hell are we worried about? Why are we arresting people? Why are we putting people in jail for life for possession of joints 3 times?
Yes, I think there will be that kind of spillover effect.
It's a brief period, if anything, you know, and eventually people get bored of it. And that's the lesson of the Netherlands. The amount of people that regularly used cannabis actually went down quite significantly, didn't it?
They had the lowest teenage use in the European Union. So we're here pounding on this drug about save the kids, protect the children, and meanwhile we're endangering the children at every step of this harm maximization policy that has been engineered by such narcocrats as Peter Dunne and Mike Sabin. They're making money out of it. They're getting reelected. Sabin's running his clinic, his rehab clinic, and his drug testing. It's a business for them. If you legalize cannabis, you've ripped out the vast majority of the business that they're doing right now.
Yeah.
What are they going to test for? How many people out there are doing heroin and going to work? And how easy is it to find the metabolites from heroin in their blood? It's easy to find the metabolites of marijuana, so you've got to keep it illegal because that's what you're making money out of, finding people who've smoked a joint maybe even 4 weeks ago or even 2 months ago, and you can find the metabolites in their blood still. So you've found them, you've caught them. Yay, yeah, we're doing something for society. We're catching the criminals. We're weeding out the you know, bad element. You know, and meanwhile, you can get absolutely pie-eyed drunk, come to work the next day, hungover. You won't be found out in your drug test, because they're not testing for alcohol. You won't be eliminated from your job because of use of an illegal drug. You can just carry on coming to work each day hungover, no problem.
And frequently people do.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And people frequently go to work high as well.
They do, and they function fine.
While operating heavy machinery sometimes.
Sometimes,
it's not recommended.
Well, sometimes better. I mean, some people need it to be able to concentrate. Some people find that it helps them function in their day-to-day life.
Well, this is another element. It has different effects, different strokes for different folks, horses for courses.
That's right.
I've seen some people without marijuana who are just terrible people, you know. They're, and it's not just their personality that gets terrible. It's when they're using alcohol, they just get violent and whatever. Yet you see them smoking and there's none of those negative effects, none of that aggression, none of that sort of BS about it. It's actually really safe for them. Other people, on the other hand, they freak out massively, and then they don't do it again. And it's pretty straightforward, you know. It's like, hey, you didn't die, you survived it, and now you'd realize that you're not one of those people who should be smoking.
That's right. There's a self-selection process when it comes to the use of this drug. You find that when people have negative reactions to it, they abstain, they don't use it. The idea that they use it once and then they're on the road to ruin, which eventuates in heroin addiction, that is one of the hugest myths of our time, and it was invented by the same Harry J. Anslinger. He is the father of the gateway theory.
The gateway theory, of which everybody drinks alcohol, then takes drugs. We'll be right back.